The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. What I had in mind for this evening is to try to talk to you a little bit about the Buddhist teaching on not self. The teaching on not self is somewhat infamous for being sometimes difficult to understand, perplexing. What do you mean there's no self? You know, if there's no self, then, you know, who brought me here today? You know, I was the one who brought me here, so there's a self that operates. There's many reasons people get perplexed. One of them is, in fact, because people think the teaching is that there is no self. And in fact, we don't find anywhere that the Buddha taught that there is no self. He was asked point blank, is there a self or is there no self? And he refused to answer the question. And in other places he pointed out that to have the view that there is no self just leads to confusion. Now, there are many books that teach that many Buddhist teachers who insist that what the Buddha was teaching was there is no self. Some people might find very helpful that teaching, but it wasn't what he taught. And I think that the premise to start the discussion of Buddhism or Buddhist practice from the point of a philosophical point or an idea like this, that there is no self or something like that, is starting at the wrong place. I think many people come to Buddhism with ideas about wanting to know who they are, wanting to know the truth, and often it's like, I want to have an understanding, I want to see what's true, and what can be more true than trying to understand who you are, and to understand this is who I am, or this is who I'm not this, there is no self in some deep way. Some people it's very satisfying, very meaningful, and some people it's just confusing to hear it. But rather than approaching Buddhism from the point of view of some belief and teaching like this, there's a whole other way of approaching it. And if you approach it from this other way that I'm going to try to explain tonight, perhaps this teaching of not-self will become much more obvious and something that you can recognize for yourself. You don't need any philosophical explanation for how it works. And the way is to not begin by philosophy or ideas, but to begin with a mind that's meditating. And there's many things that can happen when people meditate, and don't want to say that it's supposed to be any particular way. But generally, meditation is associated with the becoming calm. This happens sometimes. And what calm means is that the normal agitation, activity of the mind and the body calms down. If you're busy, living a busy life, or an anxious life, or a greedy life, the mind can be spinning quite fast. The body itself can get quite agitated and worked up and a lot of energy and everything going. And sometimes it's quite a surprise to people to sit down to be quiet and to realize they can't be quiet because of how much energy, activity, thoughts, feelings are churning away. But then as people learn a little bit more about meditation, develop the capacity to get a little more focused, mindful, step away from their entanglement with all their thoughts, their ideas, and their feelings, then at some point the body and mind starts getting calmer. Sometimes it comes with other qualities, not just calmness, but sometimes a feeling of contentment, sometimes a feeling of peace, sometimes a feeling of being whole, complete, as opposed to being fragmented or incomplete in some way. There's a variety of kind of nice ways of feeling or being that can happen. So for now, let's take the idea that the mental activity calms down. And imagine that maybe it calms down quite a bit. So you're hardly thinking at all. You're not thinking much about things. Then you come to the end of your meditation. And what happens when you come out of meditation is as important as what happens when you're in meditation. Some people, when the meditation's over, they just going, you know, jump up and start their day and forget about that. But the transition from coming from meditation out of meditation and into your life is a time where you can watch, you can notice and watch carefully how the activity of your mind gets reemerges. Because sooner, if you're calm and settled in meditation, chances are you're not going to keep that when you start your day. And if you go back into your full swing of your day, you might carry with you a little bit of calmness through the day. It's one of the reasons some people like to meditate. So they carry a kind of a current of calmness or settledness. But it's all too easy still to get caught up and involved in all the things that you're doing. But if you watch carefully, what happens as you begin to reemerge the activity of the mind, one of the things you might notice is that a recreation, a reappropriation, a reassertion of a particular kinds of mental activities. And one of those mental activities that's very important for human beings is the mental activity that creates a sense of self, that creates ideas of self. So you might come out of meditation if you're a parent, you come out of, like me, I come out of meditation, and one of the things I think about soon after being, you know, coming out of meditation are thoughts related to being a parent. Got to make breakfast for those kids and get them ready for school, and I have to be a good parent, whatever. This idea of being a good parent comes up. But a month or two ago, it happened that I got out of my morning meditation and my two sons were not home. And it took a moment to catch on, because the idea that I was a parent and I had to act like a parent was such a habit that I could watch it created, but they weren't home. They were off on school trips and stuff, right? So being a parent wasn't needed. But then there's other selves to be. My wife was home, so I got to be a husband. And so the husband thoughts began to arise. But it has happened that I've had times where neither my kids nor my wife have been home. So then, what arises then? There's no need to be a husband and have husband thoughts, no need to have father thoughts. What kind of thoughts, you know, arise then? Maybe, you know, for your sake, I have teacher thoughts. You know, oh, I've got to be a teacher. And then I have thoughts about being a teacher. Or, you know, there's a variety of kind of thoughts that might arise. I might, you know, I like to go to the gym in the morning sometimes. And so, you know, that doesn't happen to me, but maybe it could happen. Like, you know, like my identity issues with being in the gym. Like, it's really important to have a certain kind of shorts. You know, really, it's important to be, you know, it's important to kind of be a certain kind of man when you go to the gym and, you know, and show people how strong I am and, you know, and maybe I should oil up the muscles a little bit. And so they shine. And because, you know, when you go to the gym, it's important to be seen, right? And things like that. Actually, one of the gym I like is so nice. I like because where I go, because I don't think anybody looks at anybody. And there's all these, you know, people in every possible funky clothes. And, you know, so it's not that kind of place. But it could be that kind of place, right? I oil up my muscles before I go to the gym. And so what you see then is a kind of a creation of a self, ideas about who I am that come into play. Some of these ideas about self have some semblance to reality. Maybe I am a father, I am a husband, I am a gym goer. You know, so there's some things like, you know, like when I go to the gym, there's certain identity that's important to have with me and to keep that identity close at hand. Because if I don't keep this identity close at hand, I'm going to get in big trouble and other upset people. And that is, it's important to remember that I'm a man. And because I can't go into the wrong room, the woman's room, right, to change. And so there's a certain identity association, I'm a man, that is a useful one to have at that time. So what I'm trying to say is that it's possible to be in meditation and have any kinds of thought about who I am not operate, because you're calm and settled, and it can be a very content, peaceful place. And then as we come out of meditation, a variety of different kinds of thoughts about who I am come into play. Some of them might be accurate enough, but some of them are accurate but not needed. You don't need to operate on them all the time. Some of them are inaccurate. One of the forms of thinking that the Buddha said is a manifestation of clinging is the thought that I am good, and also the thought I am bad. Both of those are forms of clinging, he said, in a particular sutta, and are not necessary to have those kinds of thoughts. It's just, it's a kind of selfing. And so we talk in Buddhism about this phenomena of selfing, of creating a sense of self, creating ideas of me, myself, and mine. Now, you could argue, which some people will, well, there's, what's wrong with that? Of course there's things which are mine. Of course there's me. Of course there's I. And, you know, these Buddhists don't know what they're talking about. That's one option. If you think, another option is, which I think is the Buddhist approach, is not to get into the philosophy of this, but to watch the activity of your mind. What happens in your mind when you come out of this calm, settled state? And you can see how the mind has a thought, an idea, a sense that gets created, that arises. And when it arises and you see it emerge, then you can ask yourself an amazing question. And the amazing question is, do I need to use it? Do I need to have it right now? Is it necessary? If you are calm and settled, and you see that the ideas of self that are come into operation are agitating, bring discontent, it causes you to lose some of your peace, then the question, is it necessary to really do this, becomes even more interesting. Maybe I don't have to assume this identity right now. Maybe I don't have to act in this identity or believe in it. Or what happens if I just stay relaxed, open, and just operate in the world without such a strong sense of self, idea of self? When I was a relatively new practitioner, I began to see very clearly how attached I was to ideas of self. And one way, one form that I took was, it was really important to me how people saw me. I had to be seen a certain way. And so I would do a variety of social gymnastics to try to help make sure that people were, you know, I was going to manipulate people, right? To make sure that people would see me for how I wanted to be seen. I have no idea how successful it was. But there was one place I went where whatever I was trying to do just obviously didn't work, the social games. And that's when I went to a San Francisco Zen Center, where I first practiced Zen Center, practiced Buddhism. And I found it really kind of jarring at first that I'd go into a social situation and I'd play my nice skill games. And there was no response. They weren't buying it. There was no, like, it was like this, you know, like just, you know, it didn't go anywhere. It's like, and people there were like mirrors. I got to see what I was doing because there was no, my usual responses that I was got from my friends and people. And it was kind of jarring, but then when I started to appreciate it, I said, I want to go live with those people because I need help. I want to be challenged in this way so I don't keep falling back into this, you know, social thing of trying to be someone for other people and all this thing I was doing. And as this proceeded, I did move to Green Gulch, to Zen Center, and I was challenged in this way by the community there and by the practice there. And there came to a point where, you know, because of what was happening in meditation, the settled, the dropping away of this, temporarily, that I saw how I was caught up in self and self-identity issues and how I wanted to be seen, how I wanted to be presented, and who I thought I had to be in the eyes of other people. I could see it very, very clearly. And I knew that in order that what was called on for me was to let go of that, kind of like step into the abyss, let go of that. And I was afraid to. I would stand there. It felt like I was standing at the edge of a cliff, and I knew I had to let go. But it was a cliff. You can't step over the edge of the cliff. So it took me a long time before I was willing to kind of take that step, and somehow enter into the world or be in the world without this usual senses of self and ideas of who I am that were operating. So, from meditation, then, you can begin watching the activities of your mind. And as you track the activities of your mind and how your mind functions, you can become aware of what activities in your mind are a drag, are not so nice. Just nice, even if they're philosophically true. maybe there is a real self. But you can watch how the thinking about the real self and how important it is, and it's important for everybody to see it, it's just a drag on the mind. It's a wind drag. The mind contracts, it gets narrow, it slows it down. Any kind of thinking about... So one of my definitions of self, someone asks, what is the self? Good question, right? So my answer is, it's wind drag. Because so many times when we're caught up in ideas of who we are, it really inhibits us, slows us down. It involves resistance. It involves things. Not all the time, but sometimes. And so you can watch sometimes in meditation, coming out of meditation, how to come, you can watch the cost of picking up and getting involved in these thoughts about self, selfing that go on. And then you don't have to be involved in philosophical questions. Is there or is not a self? Maybe that's not so interesting. What's interesting is to say, this selfing that I'm doing right now, this selfing is not necessary. And maybe I can learn to let go of it. Maybe there's another way of operating in the world. So then we get to something I think that's also interesting, is that part of the selfing is we do have perspectives for how, about what's going on. We always have a perspective. And what's the perspective we have about ourselves? Sometimes it's useful to have a perspective that you are something, that there is a kind of self here. And sometimes it's useful to have a perspective that this is not myself. For example, my wife, when she was in her early 30s, for about 3 months, she had medically induced menopause, a hormone treatment. And sometime in the middle of this, she said to me, I'm having all these bizarre thoughts, but they're not my thoughts. And that was pretty wise, Usually, usually some people think, that I think, therefore I am. They believe, because they're thinking it, that's true, it's who I am. But she had enough wisdom to see that these were not really hers. They were kind of medically induced, drug-induced kind of thinking. They were kind of bizarre. And so her relationship to those thoughts was much easier, much lighter. Just thoughts happening, and she didn't identify with them. If you come into, IMC, and like you're sitting in a place here, and in some kind of easy, light way, when you take a seat, a chair or a cushion and sit on the floor, it's yours for the duration of the time, for this meditation, perhaps, in the talk. And you don't think about that much, that it's mine. But then you have to go to the bathroom. So in the middle of the meditation, middle of the talk, you get up and go to the bathroom. And then you come back. And while you were gone, someone sat there. Now, the fact that this is yours becomes much more prominent. And the idea, this is mine. It was my, how could someone? And then with that sense of mine comes self-righteousness, comes hurt, comes all kinds of stuff. is it necessary to get involved in the mental activity of this is my chair and my cushion, this is wrong, the person's doing it? Is it necessary to get involved in those activities? The authority of justice can be so strong. The authority that I'm right can be so strong. The authority of being hurt can be so strong that of course I have to do be involved in this activity and spin out, you know, maybe. Or you can watch and see, this was just a creation of my mind, an activity of my mind to assume or to create, this is my chair. And I'm only really latched onto it as my chair because someone's sitting in it. If no one had sat in it, as soon as I left IMC, I would have had no thoughts that it was mine. And I probably wouldn't even have remembered which chair I sat in. But it's an activity of the mind, the idea of possessiveness. This is my thing. The famous story of Suzuki Roshi, there's a photograph of him saying this. I'm going to click the photograph, so it's kind of neat to see. He's holding his glasses out like this, in front of his, about, you know, a foot in front of his face, with one hand. And what he said was, these are not my glasses. But you know about my tired old eyes, so you let me use them. So that's a different way of thinking. It was his glasses, right? You know, he probably had it for a number of years. You know, it was always with him. You know, and conventionally, it was his glasses. So his perspective that he brought was, these are not my glasses, but you let me use them. Which of the, you know, the perspective, these are my glasses and these are not my glasses, which of those perspectives tends to support the mind, the heart, being at ease and relaxed? I believe that the second, these are not my glasses, is probably more relaxing. This is not my chair. It was nice they let me use it before I went to the bathroom. And now, someone else is using it. Isn't that nice? I'll figure something out. It wasn't my chair. It was never my chair. As opposed to, this is my chair. So sometimes the perspective, we can bring a perspective on our experience. And a variety of different kinds of perspectives. And the perspective we bring, the understanding we bring, can be consequential. It can create suffering or it cannot. Some of the understandings that we can bring have a lot to do with selfing, with what is mine, who I am, and all this. Is it necessary? Can we track it? Can we take responsibility for which understanding we're operating under? There are times when it's useful to have an understanding of, this is who I am. Sometimes society will tell you, you can't be that way. You know, you're not allowed to be that kind of person. And sometimes it's very hard for some people to really come forth and really take on ownership for, this is who I am, or appreciation, this is who the kind of person I am. And so there it's very valuable to come forward and have respect, this is who I am. Other times, the attachment to this is who I am, even if it's accurate, is wind drag. So, I believe in the teachings of the Buddha, his whole approach to the question of self was closer to what I'm describing today when you come out of meditation and you study the activity of your mind than it is beginning with some philosophical tenet that you have to understand. In fact, I think the Buddha was not a philosopher, but he was not trying to come up with a systematic philosophy of life in the way that maybe we think of it to be here in the West, a coherent system of thought based on, you know, fundamental premises about the nature of reality. Many times people come to religion with fundamental questions about reality, fundamental questions about who they are, what our place is in the universe. I don't think the Buddha was so interested in that, or he didn't start there. Because once you start there, you have to go to graduate school. And, you know, even then, it's not going to help. But rather, the start for the Buddha was to watch carefully how the mind actually functions and works. And where is the suffering? What kind of activity in the mind causes suffering, and what kind of activity in the mind releases you, frees you from suffering? And one of the activities that causes a lot of suffering for many, many people is the activity of selfing, self-identity issues. This is who I am. And rather than approaching this question of who I am from the philosophical, let's focus it from the point of view of where's the suffering, where's the hurt, where's the freedom in how the activity of the mind is. And so part of the value of strong, good meditation, it gives you a vantage point to understand this much more clearly than if your mind is always agitated. It's kind of maybe a little bit like if you have a piece of cloth that's really dirty, you won't notice one more stain. But if you clean the cloth really well, and then if you clean the cloth somewhat, you can see more, you know, when a new stain appears. If you bleach the cloth and it becomes really clean, then you see even the slightest little smudge that appears on it that you would ignore otherwise. We're making all these decisions about our new retreat center that we're remodeling, and what kind of tiles or something to have for the bathroom or linoleum or whatever, and what color it should be. And one of the criteria people are talking about, well, let's get a color that doesn't show all the dirt. So we don't want to have, you know, all white, right? That's what you want for your mind. It's better to have a mind that's clean so you can watch and see what goes on. But if you have a mind that's really agitated and caught up, then you won't notice, you won't learn how to take responsibility for the mind and create greater health for it as we go along. So is this making sense to you? Yeah? No, it doesn't make sense? Yes? Somewhat? So we have about 15 minutes. So now you can ask questions, you can protest, you can bring up you can point out how philosophically I've missed the mark. Anything you'd like.
Thank you. You're saying that the way I understood, the self is equal to the labels that we put on ourselves from society, like I'm a man as my gender. So if we trim off all these labels, what's going to be left? And that's one thing. And the second thing is, you said don't engage the philosophy. In what I mean is that we shouldn't use any kind of word when we are doing, we shouldn't use language in our brain when we are doing meditation in order to eliminate those labels. So we can experience that entity, which whatever it is.
So let's go to the first one first. You're saying that you said the self is, what would you say?
Labels.
Labels. So here's where maybe you want to be careful with the language you use, with how you talk about all this. It's probably not useful to say the self is anything. Rather, what you can say is that you notice that as you watch your mind, there's certain activity of the mind of creating an identity, creating thoughts about who I am, creating thoughts about what is mine. And so you can watch those activities without having to posit or claim this is the self. Does that make sense?
Almost. I think in meditation you shouldn't engage language.
So in meditation you shouldn't engage language. I don't think it's okay to engage language in meditation.
The labels.
It's okay.
Concepts get created.
I think that there's ways in which using thoughts and language in meditation can be helpful, and ways which are not helpful. And so what's important, I think, what can be helpful is to distinguish between when we use labels, when we use concepts and thinking, and it just doesn't help. It's not helpful at all. And when we can use concepts in order to help the mind get more settled and more peaceful. But if we have a blanket kind of black and white kind of absolute idea that we can't use language and can't use labels and can't use thoughts, then it might actually be too hard to really get to let wisdom operate and let understanding and let kind of the deeper reaches of meditation unfold. I think, you know, it's almost, I think it's impossible not to use labels or not to use ideas or thoughts, concepts, even in deep meditation. There are some people who say that there's no thought in deep meditation. And maybe in some ways it's true. The usual idea of verbal thoughts, the verbal conversational thoughts we might have, might stop completely. And they won't identify things as being verbal thoughts or label, but they hear a car, and there's something in their mind recognizes car. Something recognizes roar of an engine. Something recognizes, you know, an itch. And that recognition in Buddhism is considered a label. But maybe it's not verbal. Yes? If you could please use the mic.
First, thank you very much. I thought that was an excellent talk. That really cleared up a lot for me, because how you started out, I've always been perplexed by this idea of no self. And now it seems to me like it's like it doesn't really matter if there is or isn't a self. What is more important is how our mind is always just framing things. And now and then it might be beneficial. Like, say, for instance, if there's some kind of injustice that I want to stand up for, I would go, no, I want to do that. And in the activity of my life, it might be something good that helps somebody. But then when somebody insults me, and I'm like, how dare you? Don't you know who I am? And I, you know, and then it might be like, you know, why do I have to carry this? You know, I mean, why do I? Because I had an experience recently where I just, and it's funny, tonight's meditation, it kind of rose up to me that I had this hidden belief that just kind of floated up, that if I have enough of whatever, maybe obvious wealth or some kind of outer glow of strength and dignity, somehow people will never insult me, even people that I don't know. You know, and I just realized how ridiculous that is. Like, there is no amount of anything that can keep somebody who wants to insult you from insulting you. And if you're, you know, and I don't have to even be insulted by somebody I don't know.
Yes. So the Buddha said this great little poem. He says, they'll criticize you if you speak too much. They'll criticize you if you speak too little. And they'll criticize you if you speak in the middle. No one in this world is free of criticism. And that's a great poem. So people can insult you, but it doesn't have to land anywhere. But if the more you have a sense of self, a self-identity issues, and need to be a certain kind of self for people and everything, the more it has a place to land. And if it doesn't have any place to land, then, you know, you might have to deal with it in some ways, but it doesn't have to affect your inner well-being.
But am I right in assuming that now and then it could be useful to take on a self?
Yes.
For that.
So this is where the idea of a self-concept and idea is seen as a concept and idea perspective that is activity of the mind. And the criteria is this a useful activity right now, or is it not a useful activity? And sometimes it's a useful activity and sometimes it's not.
So it's kind of like desire in that, you know, it's just how your relationship to it is.
Yes.
Thank you.
And this, so great. So this saves you the perplexity of, you know, is there a true self? Is there a true self?
Hi, thank you. Can you talk a little bit more about sometimes when you actually in the practice of noticing the wind drag, but you're not in a space where you can, you know, you're trying to let it go, oh, wind drag, actual practice at that moment. I understand the continual practice, but sometimes I get the like, oh, and then I still hold it. You know, I know that the more you notice it, the more
Well, you know, when I was a kid, what I'd do with the wind drag is I put my hand out the window and, you know, let it kind of fly. And I mention this not just to be silly, but if you can't stop it, Maybe you can play around a little bit with it. Don't be oppressed by it. One of the ways to add to your suffering is to suffer because you're suffering. And so, you know, try to kind of, you know, and so not taking it as a personal fault, you know, oh, I'm so terrible because I have a sense of self. You know, that's just you adding more, you know, more self on top of self, right? So, you know, just kind of maybe even be amused by it if you can, or play with it, or you know, if you can't drop it entirely, maybe there's ways of reshaping it slightly or reusing it in different ways, or if you're around the right people, a really great practice is to confess it. I can't stop it, but there's a lot of selfing going on for me right now. You probably noticed. You know, I hope you don't mind too much, but you know, I'm struggling with it, or I'm trying to do something, but I just, you know, I can't. It has the upper hand right now. And there's something about confessing it that takes some of the power out of it, and then also maybe you get some help from your friends. And
thank you, because that is. I mean, that gives you the extra 30 seconds or minute that you need sometimes that you can't stop the wheel or the snowball. Thank you.
Let's see. I always think it's somewhat developmental, and you know, you don't want to confuse role that you may be playing in life with the self.
Right.
You need to keep at least somewhat separate, or realize that that you're dealing with things you may have to take responsibility for.
Yes.
If you're assuming a role, you take responsibility for it.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's evolutionary. You have to, as a young person, you have to be somebody before you become nobody. I forget who says that, and probably is Fritz Perl or somebody. But anyway, then you also want to watch out for when you assume roles and you're attempting to have a career, for example, you may need to be able to have a sense of self that can't be necessarily violated. You have to sort of watch your space. People will, you know, invade that space in the not in the sense of physical space, but, you know, if you're trying to develop a career, you know, it is somewhat competitive. Those are important things.
So I think the idea of roles are important. The idea that different roles require something of us, commitment, or a certain way of being in the world. But if you see it as a role, see it as an activity that is situational, then you're less likely to be fooled into thinking this is who I truly am. There's plenty of people who get identified too strongly with their role, and when the role is no longer there, they get lost. And also there's persona. There's a certain persona we put on. Persona also can take on and off a little bit. It's kind of fun to experiment with sometimes. And also, it is a developmental thing. Certain ages, we need certain kinds of self or certain kind of self-understanding. My son, when he was, my older son, I don't know how old he was, but maybe he was like seven or eight. It's for a period of time there, it seemed like it was very important for him to have the identity that he was Buddhist and our family is Buddhist. And I don't know what was going on with his friends and around him, but it was like it oriented him. It placed him in a certain kind of place. It made some sense and order of this complicated universe and everything. This is who we are and people. And so, you know, that was fine for me. I didn't mind. But I knew that this was an identity that he was latching onto, and I supported it. And now he's 14. He couldn't care less. I mean, now it's probably the opposite, you know. I keep my away from it. And so certain identities are useful. But also this another idea, you know, you need to have a strong sense of self before you let go of it. This, you know, the little bit that's a problem with that statement is that it buys into this whole idea of measuring things or framing things from the perspective of self. And what the Buddha did, seems to have done is to try to reframe the whole discussion and avoid discussing things from the point of view of self. And so instead of saying, the Buddha, I think, would instead of saying something like, you need to have a strong sense of self before you can let go of it, he would say, if what you really want to do is to let go of your clinging, it helps to develop confidence, it helps develop inner strength, it helps develop a lot of honesty, integrity. There's these inner qualities that are really helpful for that process. A modern therapist might say, well, those are the qualities that represent a strong self. But the Buddhist client will say, leave that out. No, I don't need a self, but I want those qualities. So I hope all of you will develop really, really strong qualities. And in having those qualities, that you will learn when it's useful to have some sense of self and ideas, perspectives of self, and when it's not. When you can see things as being, this is self, this is me, and when you see things, this is not self, this is not me. And making that distinction, you become freer and freer. And if you use your peace, your ease, your calm, your settled mind as a reference point for this exploration, it becomes a much more fascinating, interesting journey than if you read the books. So, thank you.